Hello, everyone, and welcome to Dream Leapers with Harriet Cole. I am so excited to be with you today. As I have been considering who to bring on to spend this special time with you today, I learned about a woman who has spent a tremendous amount of time researching our history. And she has put together a beautiful book called I Can't Wait to Call You My Wife, African-American Letters of Love and Family in the Civil War Era. It's an incredible book. Let me tell you about the author. Rita Roberts is the Nathaniel Wright Stevenson Professor of History and Biography at Scripps College and Professor of Africana Studies at the Claremont Colleges. She has authored two books, the most recent of which I just told you, I Can't Wait to Call You My Wife, was featured on Oprah's holiday gift list. So we got something pretty good, you guys. Please join me right now in welcoming Rita Roberts.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Oh, congratulations. I mean, this is a beautiful book, Rita, and a big book, like 296 pages. How long did you work on this?
Well, I cut it in half.
Ooh.
Actually, it was much larger. I was going to include public and private letters. And then realized that it probably made more sense to think about just the more mostly intimate letters between African Americans. And it works, I think.
What gave you the idea to even start the search for these letters?
I had, as a professor of African American history, many of us are asked to give talks, not just in February, but often in February. You're not surprised. To various groups, churches, fraternities, sorority organizations. And so I sort of did what I do in my classroom. I used letters, primary sources, documents to sort of pull in the audience. And I realized, and since my expertise is mostly 19th century, I love the Civil War era, I realized that it made a lot of sense to just put it down on paper and to really let us all read these letters because they're quite amazing.
They are. And just the fact that you have double the book of letters is pretty insightful for us to learn, because we know that our enslaved ancestors were, for the most part, not allowed to read or write, sometimes under threat of death if they were to gain the ability to read or write. And the fact that so many did read and write and wrote letters to each other to express their heartfelt feelings is amazing. You trace this back. So the first letter writing that you found was around what time?
Well, this period is the Civil War era, so it's the 1840s to the 1870s, but there are earlier letters. And there is poetry and, you know, Phyllis Wheatley and so on. So
sure.
There was a literate population, mostly in the North, but, I just wanted to sort of create a theme of during the greatest conflict the nation has ever known, and to show how the culture of African Americans and the centrality of family was so important in this really horrific time.
And you give a lot of context. The book opens with a lot of detail that gives historical context to what was happening. I think we can't learn enough about this period in our history. And the way that you describe it so deeply humanizes the experience, the experiences that people had. I know that you are a professor, historian, but again, finding all this, harvesting this information, can you talk about your process of discovery?
Yes. So when I decided to move beyond simply using a few documents, I started traveling to various archives. And so the John Washington letter that constitutes the title of the book, that he's talking to his fiancee, Annie Gordon, and says, I can't wait to call you my wife. I just found that so endearing. I went to the Massachusetts Historical Society, which was where the letters were at that time. The Washington papers were at that time. They're now in Virginia. But I just sat there. When I read that one letter, I couldn't put it down. I just kept reading it over and over again. And I said, okay, this is the title of my book. And now I've got to work around that and really demonstrate more of the intimacy. So Massachusetts Historical Society, the Moreland Spingarn Research Center at Howard was very important. There are some published letters already. John Blasingame, who was at Yale, Slave Testimony had letters in there. So there are various areas and archives from which to choose. And I just had to sort of narrow it down and choose specific letters.
Would you read a bit of that, the Annie letter, please?
Sure. So Annie Douglas is the youngest child of the Douglas family.
Of Frederick Douglas.
Of Frederick Douglas, yes, Frederick Douglas family. And it's a tremendous family, of course. They're abolitionist. And we can see that Annie Douglas is writing to her father, who has escaped to England because in the when John Brown engaged in the raid of the Harper's Ferry at Virginia in 1859, Frederick Douglass was blamed for it, he and several others. So Frederick Douglass escaped to England. And so Annie is writing to her dad. And this is Rochester. They live in Rochester, which is where Frederick Douglass launched the North Star. And she's writing to her dad, December 7th, 1859. And I should say John Brown had been executed December 2nd. She said, "My dear father, I'm proceeding in my German very well. For my teacher says so. I'm in the first reader and I can read." She can read German. She's excited. "I expect that you will have a German letter from me in a very short time. I've learned another piece and it is about slavery. I'm going to speak it in school. My piece is this." Would you like me to read the whole thing?
Please, sure, sure.
Okay, sure. So this is her piece that she's going to speak. "This is not the man for me who buys or sells a slave, for he who will not set him free, but send him to his grave. But he whose noble heart beats warm for all men's life and liberty, who loves alike each human form, that's the man for me." And then she goes on and says that it is in the Garland of Freedom and four verses of it. So it will be in this book. And she said, "My letter will not be very long. Poor Mr. Brown is dead. That hard-hearted man said he must die. And they took him in an open field in about half a mile from the jail and hung him. The German children like me very much, but I have gone ahead of them and they have been there longer than me too." She's just bragging a little bit. And she says, "They all send their love from your affectionate daughter, Annie Douglas."
I love so much about that, including, you know, the personalization of the Douglas family. I mean, many, obviously, Frederick Douglass is one of those iconic figures that everybody knows. You know, I don't know how much they know about him, Rita, but they know something. They know he was an abolitionist. Some people know that he founded the newspaper, the North Star. But to have a peek into his relationship with his daughter is something that's really, really special.
It is too. I agree so much. And his other daughter, his eldest child, Rosetta, has a wonderful relationship with her dad. Very voluminous letters written. Many are at the Library of Congress. They write back and forth to one another, and it's such an important relationship. I just love their relationship.
Oh, that's so great. Okay, I know there are plenty more. What's the next one you'd like to share with us?
So there, I like to demonstrate the complexity and the diversity of African-American experience. Most of us were enslaved. Most African-Americans were enslaved. 4 million, 1860s. That's the vast majority. And about half a million were free. About half in the North and half in the South were free. So I like to read letters written by those who were enslaved. And this is a letter written by Emily Russell. She's writing from the Alexandria jail in which she is put. A slave trader bought her, put her in that jail, and she is awaiting being taken down to the South, to New Orleans. New Orleans had brothels for women who were far more European, actually, at that African descent. And that's where she was going to be taken. They were called fancy girls. And rather than to get into the graphic sexual proclivities of that time and perhaps this, I'll just read her letter. And she's writing to her mother, and she says, "My dear mother," this is 1850, January 22nd, "I take this opportunity of writing you a few lines to inform you that I am in Bruin's jail, and Aunt Sally and all of her children and Aunt Hager and all of their children and grandmother is almost crazy. They're all there. Someone must have died, probably died, and then they were to be auctioned off by the heirs. My dear mother, will you please come to me? Come on as soon as you can. I expect to go away very shortly. Oh, mother, my dear mother, come now and see your distressed and heartbroken daughter. Once more, mother, my dear mother, do not forsake me, for I feel desolate. Please to come now, your daughter, Emily Russell." And then she says, "If you do not come as far as Alexandria, come to Washington and do what you can." She wants her mother to purchase her. She wants her mother to raise money. She wants to get out of there. She does not want to go to the South. Within days of writing her letter, Emily died on the trip to New Orleans.
So she was making the effort to come get her daughter.
Trying to. And Emily is the daughter, and she's the one who dies. I'm sure the mother was doing all she could.
Okay. Emily is the one who passed away.
Emily is the one who died.
I want to share something with you, Rita, that as you're saying this, it reminds me, I have a copy of the manumission papers of my great-grandmother from June 4th, 1850. And she was named Harriet, like me. She was Harriet Ann. And we don't have letters, but what we know is that we don't know when she became free. If she was always free, that's a question. But her husband and children were about to be auctioned off in Maryland, in Annapolis. She was from the Calvert County area. And she somehow raised money, and as a free woman, and walked 40 miles from Calvert County to Annapolis to buy back her husband and children before they were sold off and shipped away, which is an incredible story. That's amazing. I learned because I was bemoaning my name when I was a little girl. Why did you give me this old-fashioned name? And kids were teasing me about my name. You know how kids can be.
Yes.
And my mother sat me down and she said, "Look, young lady, let me tell you about your name." And one half of the story about my name was about Harriet Ann, my great-grandmother. And what an incredible story. And your book is filled with these stories. Also, what you just mentioned about the jail. So when there were lots of reasons that enslaved people ended up in jail, and you talk about that. Can you give us an understanding of that?
So the jails were established. There were trading posts, auction areas, and just Alexandria jail, and then there were auction posts where enslaved people were taken and then to be auctioned off and usually to be sold to the Deep South. The Upper South was switching to a more diverse agricultural economy, so they were no longer as dependent upon tobacco. Now cotton took over. And so Virginia, the colony and the state that had the most enslaved people, and Maryland began selling enslaved people south. Many of those in Maryland, speaking of your grandmother, Harriet Ann, gained freedom. They were allowed to purchase freedom, some often right after the Revolutionary War, purchase their own freedom. If they were owned by Quakers, they may have been freed. So, you know, very diverse circumstances depended upon the situation in Maryland. Most of those in Virginia were simply sold south, as were many in Maryland as well. And so there were jails. So what happens is that we see a repetition of the system, not the exact, but very similar to the Middle Passage, in which we see not on the ocean, but in the states, enslaved people being collected in the jails and then transported to the Deep South, sometimes by ship, often by overland. And so it became very common to have auction houses throughout the states. The capital of Washington, D.C., across from the Capitol, had an auction house. And these spaces are throughout the southern states, and individuals are collected again, as they were in dungeons in West Africa, and then brought, when there was a significant number, slave traders would take them to the Deep South for extraordinary amounts of money.
It's heartbreaking to hear. You know, that film 12 Years a Slave kind of showed a window into that, where a free man was snatched and ended up enslaved for so long, at least not forever. That was based on a true story. But, you know, exactly. To learn the horrors of, you know, here's the thing. I wonder, in your research, let me ask it this way. What I'm thinking about is the mindset that existed. First of all, one could think, I can enslave you. Like, what? It's just so incredibly mind blowing that I just don't understand it at all. But what was it like? What was it like for the enslaved people kind of pondering, why is this my fate? Mm-hmm. Do you have letters to talk about that?
Well, I think narratives as well. Frederick Douglass's narrative, Sullivan Northup's narrative is different, obviously, from Douglass's, but there are many, many other slave narratives of fugitive slaves who then went north or to Canada and wrote their story, partly as abolitionist propaganda to persuade individuals to become abolitionist. But what we need to understand, I think, is important is that enslaved people do not become mentally enslaved. We need to understand that. So it seems that the textbooks get it wrong because they use terms like dehumanization. Enslaved people were dehumanized. That is not true. The system was dehumanizing because the system asserted that individuals were more property than human. Enslaved people did push back against that in various ways, but family was most central.
Yes.
Because slavery was not only racial slavery, justified the construction of race, that Europeans are superior to all people of African descent, but it was also kinlessness. It was a system of kinlessness. So, even though an individual, quote, married, they were not legally married. They had no power over one another or themselves.
Right.
They were kinless. So what individuals do is assert their humanity, the sort of universal humanity, through establishing kin. Family is central, and community. Mm-hmm. And that's why I say all the time, protest is embedded in the African-American culture, the African-American culture, those who came. We need to understand that they are not enslaved mentally. They push back against that. And your great-grandmother's story is just an example of that. It just illustrates very well exactly the point I'm making in the book.
Yeah, it's so true. And, you know, the first book that I wrote is called Jumping the Broom, The African-American Wedding Planner. So,
yes.
Which I wrote many years ago now and did some research into early wedding traditions as well as those over the years. But you know, one of the things that we learned is that people did jump the room that indicated that they were married, even though they weren't legally allowed to marry. They created family in all the ways that they could. Of course, and you write about this, you have letters and also your narrative in the book talking about even when they did that, because it wasn't legal, they could snatch the wife away or snatch children away, because part of what was so effective about slavery was the baby making component. The more people who were created, the more efficient the farms would work.
Yes. And as I say in the introduction, Thomas Jefferson acknowledges this very early on and refers to increase, meaning that there was incredible dependency upon African-American women's productive capacities. And so that kind of dependency is never acknowledged, but we need to realize the degree to which the system that argued that we were dependent and could not function unless under the control of European Americans was the opposite. That system could not function without being dependent upon the reproductive capacity of African American women.
What are you hoping people will walk away with after reading your book?
A wonderful question, and I always rethink this. This is what I'm thinking today. I absolutely want us all Americans and people in the world to understand the incredible complexity and diversity of African American experience. This is part of American history, and we need to understand that without understanding the importance of it, we will not really understand who we are. And the past really informs the present. We need to understand who we are, as James Baldwin said so much better than I, that we don't know who we are or where we are unless we know from whence we came. So I'm really hoping that we have a better understanding of who we are of the past, for the present. And I want us to affirm one another as family members. I want us to affirm family more importantly. And I think our politics could stress the importance of family and really push back against those who would do all they could to prevent us from maintaining and forming families.
And do you think the us that you're talking about can include everyone? Do you believe that European Americans can read this book and find their way to a good space? Because a lot of times when thinking about the period of slavery, it's so difficult that they just don't even want to do it.
Right. And I think that that's a willing ignorance. I think that it's a very convenient way of not knowing and arguing that it doesn't exist. I used to have students who would say to me, my ancestors, this is in Southern California, so there were very few, but my ancestors were kind slaveholders.
Mm.
And I would just repeat Frederick Douglass's statement, Frederick Douglass said there was no such thing as a kind slaveholder. The idea of owning another human being is antithetical to being human. And that's what we need to understand. And so there's no such thing as kind slave system. Slavery is about ownership of another human being.
Which there's nothing kind about that, nothing even rational about that. We are talking to Rita Roberts, the author of I Can't Wait to Call You My Wife, African-American Letters of Love and Family in the Civil War Era. If you would like to have a copy of this book, please contact us at WBAI. Make a contribution of $75. You can get one of the 5 books that Rita has so generously given to us. You can write to us at give2wbai.org, give the numeral 2wbai.org. Do so now. We have 5 copies and you can get yours right away. Thank you so much, Rita Roberts. What
so
a treasure
welcome.
This book is.
My
really,
pleasure.
Really amazing. And thank you, everybody, for tuning in. We appreciate you. Maybe you can offer this book to someone you love. It is, again, called I Can't Wait to Call You My Wife, African-American Letters of Love and Family in the Civil War Era.
WPFW in Washington and WBAI New York. I'm Chris Bangert-Drowns with some brief news headlines. The United States will send 31 Abrams battle tanks to Ukraine, President Biden told reporters this afternoon, after Germany formally announced that it would send 14 of its Leopard tanks to Ukraine. Biden said European allies have agreed to send an additional 62 Leopards. The U.S. had for weeks urged its European allies to donate Leopards to Ukraine, while holding out on sending the Abrams over concerns that complex training and maintenance needs would render it ineffective. According to the Associated Press, the Abrams tanks will be provided through an upcoming security assistance package rather than through existing military stockpiles, meaning it could take months or even years before the tanks reach Ukraine. The Leopard tanks, on the other hand, are likely to be more immediately available and are easier to learn to use. Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov called the Western deployment of tanks, quote, extremely dangerous, and said it would, quote, not bode well from the point of view of global and pan-European security, end quote. In domestic news, House Speaker Kevin McCarthy last night formally rejected the reappointments of Democrats Adam Schiff and Eric Swalwell to the powerful House Intelligence Committee. McCarthy has argued that both Schiff and Swalwell are unfit to serve on the committee, citing Schiff's work conducting the first impeachment investigation of President Trump and Swalwell's alleged ties to a Chinese intelligence operative. There is no evidence of wrongdoing in relation to the allegation against Swalwell. Some have suggested that McCarthy's decision was instead a retaliation after Democrats in 2021 ejected GOP lawmakers Marjorie Taylor Greene of Georgia and Paul Gosar of Arizona from congressional committees for internet posts that advocated violence against their political opponents. McCarthy returned both Greene and Gosar to committees earlier this month. Fulton County, Georgia, Superior Court Judge Robert McBurney said yesterday that the final grand jury report on then-President Trump's effort to get the state to reverse his 2020 election loss would remain secret for the time being. McBurney said he needed more time to deliberate and that he would announce his decision in the coming days. A consortium of media outlets had asked McBurney yesterday to make the report public, as the grand jury recommended. Arguing against that action, Fulton County District Attorney Fannie Willis made the case that the report should remain sealed until she has made a public announcement about whether she plans to bring criminal charges or not. Willis told the judge that charging decisions for multiple people, quote, are imminent, and that releasing the report now could impact the right of numerous defendants to have a fair trial. And classified documents were found in former Vice President Mike Pence's home last week, his lawyer announced yesterday. The lawyer said Pence was unaware of the existence of the documents until last week's search, and said the files are in FBI custody. Yesterday's announcement came as the Department of Justice is already investigating the discovery of classified files in the homes of President Biden and former President Trump. Both Pence and Biden appear to be cooperating with authorities, while Trump has made numerous excuses for not turning over his documents promptly, even claiming that he had declassified the files by simply thinking about it. Weather in Washington, D.C. right now is 40 degrees with rain. In New York City, 40 degrees and overcast. For WPFW in Washington and WBAI New York, I'm Chris Bangert-Drowns. Thanks for listening.